You're listening to episode 7 of season 9 of the GNU World Order. Hi everyone, this is Klaatu and this is the GNU World Order. It's episode 7 of season 9, as I've just stated. So you may ask, what is GNU World Order? Well, it's a technical OG cast, that is, I talk about technical things, for instance, computers and Linux and GNU and other topics related to those, and I do so in a free audio codec, OG Vorbis, well, and also Speaks, actually, so both of those are free audio codecs. So that's the GNU World Order in a nutshell. In today's episode, we're going to talk about, well, we're going to continue the Programming 101 series. So today we're going to tackle Python. And I realize that in a sense, I haven't really fully covered Bash yet. And I'm aware of this, and if you want more Bash practice, I'll give you some links for that. I'll also talk a little bit about the way that I'm presenting these topics and these lessons, and follow up on where you can find more information, even along the same lines as the lessons that I'm providing here. But first things first, that is listeners' feedback. Listener feedback this time around can be summarized in kind of one way, and that is that multiple people have pointed out to me that while I may have had good intentions in my last in the last example of what I called object-oriented dice game in Bash, they really, really differed with me on the idea of even saying it was object-oriented, which I wasn't. I was not saying it was object-oriented, true object-oriented, but I was trying to say that this is an object-oriented-like behavior. And a lot of listeners said, well, no, you're just plain wrong. It is procedural programming, and that is what that is. You know, by taking Bash scripts and placing them in functions, that doesn't make it object-oriented. And again, I thought I said, and I'm pretty sure I did say in the episode itself, that Bash is in no way an object-oriented language. So I thought that would be enough. But I got snagged on a technicality, and frankly, after talking to a couple of people about it, I realized that it's a significant technicality, and you can gloss over things sometimes, and you can fake things sometimes, and sort of gloss over certain technicalities, but at some point, if you gloss over too much, it just becomes basically misinformation or disinformation. So I'm going to sort of retract the term object-oriented from the last episode, at least in spirit. I mean, I'm not going to go back and re-edit it, because that's silly, I think, in this case. I've gone back and re-edited things before and appended a letter after the name of the episode to show that it's been changed. And I don't know, maybe at some point I will do that for the previous episode, but probably not, because everything's changed. I've changed the text online, and I'm revising it now as we go forward. So rather than saying that the dice example in the last episode was object-oriented like, I'm just going to say, hey, sorry, it was procedural. And that is much more accurate. I got a couple of good ideas on what would be a better example of an object-oriented like, what sets procedural and object-oriented apart. And that's not what we're going to go in this episode, because it was already in my lesson plan anyway, but not yet. It's the next episode, it's the next lesson, and it is a Python, truly object-oriented version of the dice game in Python. And in that case, it will be doing things that really specifically, you know, that object-oriented stuff, I mean, that's what it does. And I think maybe one of the best explanations of what that means was from, like I keep saying, there are a lot of people who talked to me about this, so I'm not saying that this was the only one, and maybe saying it's the best is not correct, but either way, the one that sort of stuck with me was Ken Fallon's explanation of it, and his idea was, you know, a proper dice object-oriented program would have something such as, well, in his own words, possibly, object-oriented language part of a language is where you call something that has methods and you don't concern yourself with how it's done unless you are writing the method yourself. So you could have something, for instance, like my dice equals dice new. My dice now provide sides, 6 sides, print my dice, and throw the dice. So, you know, you've got like these things such as there's this method called dice, and then you assign to that how many sides you want the dice to have, or something like that. And that was a great idea, and I really liked the idea of being able to define how many sides your die had. So in next episode, I modified the original lesson, which originally was just basically a re-implementation of the Bash dice game, but in Python with, you know, I guess really object-oriented characteristics, but giving it the ability to say, okay, this is how many sides the dice that we're about to throw has, and even going so far as to then taking user input and letting the user decide how many sides their die is going to have. I thought that was a really great idea. And so we'll see a little bit more about what really is object-oriented versus procedural versus scripted in the next episode. In this episode, I really just kind of want to get started with Python. And I'm drinking Earl Grey tea right now. But yeah, in this episode, we're just going to do... That was just an aside, just for your information, Earl Grey. In this episode, we'll talk about Python, mostly. And as I stated, and there was more feedback, and it was all appreciated, and I believe that I responded to everyone personally, and if not, at this point, I'm just going to say, everyone who responded to that, thank you. And the reason I'm not going to go further into that, and actually, before I do say what I was about to say, I do want to mention something that I got from Doug or Bruce. I don't really remember, or I don't really know what his exact name is, but he sent me an example of a program, a Python program, which he placed in pastie.org. That's pastie.org/8523628. And if you go to that link, you can see his example program, which is really, really useful. I don't know how long it'll be on pastie.org, so I've also stole it and put it on the GNU World Order site. But it covers something called argparse. And argparse is something in Python that lets the user, or the programmer rather, parse input from the user. And this has nothing to do really with object-oriented. This could be done in a scripted application. But for instance, we were talking earlier in this season about bash argument parsing. And this is the Python method of doing that. So we'll use this in the next episode as well, I think. And for now, if you want to look at it, it's in pastie.org/8523628, and I'll also put it on GNU World Order so you can have it there for future proofing it. I don't know how long pastie.org keeps their pasted information online. Okay, so that's kind of covers the listener feedback. I actually had a lot more to say about listener feedback in an earlier take of this same episode, but somehow I really screwed up the audio file that I rendered from that earlier take, and with some recent things that have been going on, I really didn't have a chance to just go back and re-export it and stuff like that. I really screwed it up. So I'm going to tell you what exactly all of that is about in a moment. I did want to briefly address something that a guy named Jonathan, I won't say his last name on air, but it's Jonathan R., you know who you are, emailed me with a lot of that object-oriented stuff, but also he said that he found my rant against Secure Boot a little bit strange because, what would you do? You'd tell everyone to just run as root. I mean, just because a security measure isn't perfect doesn't mean it's useless. The problem with secure boot stems from the implementation more than with the idea of making life difficult for firmware infecting malware. I'm going to admit that I'm not a security expert, and I'm going to say that Jonathan could be correct about this, but I'm going to maintain my severe skepticism about secure boot and even about the idea that you know, something needs a digital signature in order to do something. As long as the user has control over these digital signatures, I guess that's not the worst thing in the world. But I do question the value of having a centralized authority that defines what is an acceptable digital signature and what is not a digital signature, and then to have that central authority program in firmware the acceptability or the non-acceptability of that, you know, of that certificate. I mean, that's the same reason I don't really love you know, VeriSign and all these other things, where there is, again, a centralized authority, and if you're not one of the developers who has paid the magic amount of money to get one of these fancy digital certificates, then you are forever, you know, branded as suspect. And I mean, the fact that Firefox and Thunderbird both, you know, alert me when I go to certain places because, oh, that's not a, you know, it's a self-issued certificate and it's not in our database, so be very careful, and you have to explicitly issue a security exception in order to get there, I have issues with that. So I have the same issue with this happening as in the form of secure boot. And I don't agree with that. I mean, if I want to roll my own whatever, and you know, whether it's an operating system or a boot image or whatever, I should be able to do that. I shouldn't need an official approved digital certificate or key or whatever. So yeah, I still have issue with it. I don't know that it's entirely based on the implementation of it. I do recognize, however, Jonathan, that probably a lot of it is with the implementation. I mean, in theory, yeah, having a system where you're checking, is this certificate matching what the user has said they will accept as something that can be flashed on this firmware or booted, you know, an acceptable next step in this firmware process. You know, if it was something that the user could definitely manage and had control over, then yeah, I guess I wouldn't have as much of an issue about it. I also, however, and maybe it is just the fact that the user is cut out so severely from this process, but I do really wonder about companies trying to place all of these safeguards on things when ultimately the responsibility really does need to lie with the user, in my opinion. But I don't know. There's room for argument, and there's room for debate there. So I will agree to converse further about this topic. I'm not going to say that I have a definitive opinion on it even, but certainly I'm very, very suspicious about it myself. But thank you very much, everyone, for the feedback. Other people gave me feedback, but I don't want to get too far into it, because I want to segue into an announcement, an important announcement, and then I want to segue into, of course, programming. So let's get on to the announcement. Okay, the important announcement is that I'm actually, and this is not just an announcement, it's a bit of a warning or something, but I'm actually moving to New Zealand, of all places. Got a position doing Linux work for a company, and I'm very excited, but the reality of it is that the shows may start to become a little bit delayed here and there just within the next couple of weeks while I get myself to New Zealand, which from the east coast of the U.S. is quite a ways away. So it's going to, you know, my life lately has been fairly busy with a lot of paperwork, work visas, things like that, travel arrangements, trying to get ready for the new job, and reading up on APIs and all this other stuff. The APIs that I'll be using, it turns out, are very familiar to me. I'm very excited about it. Or not the APIs, but the technologies that are involved in a lot of the stuff that I'll be doing. It's very exciting. It's a lot of very familiar technology. It's Python, C++, and Qt. So I'm really, really, really excited. And a cool Python documentation system, actually, that I kind of just recently found out about, that I guess I'll probably talk a lot about next episode. But for now, yes, just be warned that if, like this very episode itself, actually, if there is a delay in the regularly scheduled release schedule, the regularly scheduled releases of this show, don't think that I'm abandoning the show or losing interest in it or whatever. It's just literally that I'm just absolutely too busy to be able to do a whole lot else other than just getting myself out of the country. So that is the explanation of why this show itself is late and why there may be some delays down the line. Apropos to that, I am getting rid of a lot of stuff, a few extra things that I had lying around that I had intended to take to different Linux conferences and give away or sell in some cases. And one of those things, one of the things that I'm giving away that I need to get rid of are books. And the book that I'm thinking of right now is the programming book from which all these programming lessons are derived. This is actually an older version of the book because I've recently updated the text specifically to become more familiar with the Python documentation that I will be using at this new job in New Zealand. But I can't take like 5 or 6 copies of this programming book with me, so I need to get rid of it. So if you email me and ask me for a copy of the book, I will send it to you. Again, it's not necessarily the most recent version, but there are still some very good things in it, and it is a hard copy, so it's sometimes easier to follow along the hard copy than, for instance, the online version, or even a PDF version. So if you want a hard copy, for free, email me. I will send it to you. You need to do that fairly quickly. I need to get the names and the addresses and get them sent out right now while I have the chance, because otherwise I'm going to be too busy to be bothered. So let me know. And if you do that, I'll send you probably some stickers and some not GNU World Order stickers, just random stickers that I got at technical conferences. So there'll probably be more than one thing in the shipment. You can consider that a Christmas gift to you, my dear listener. And also, I will thank you profusely for helping me get rid of things that I cannot fit into a suitcase and take across the world with me. So let me know. Please, just email me. That's, of course, klaatu@member.fsf.org or klaatu@hackerpublicradio.org or whatever you choose. Speaking of Hacker Public Radio, unrelated to anything, New Year's Eve is coming up very, very quickly here. There is an all-day, 24-hour Hacker Public Radio show on New Year's Eve, and of course the start and the end times are very confusing because there are different time zones, and if you are in, let's say, I don't know, New Zealand, then it would start a lot earlier than it would start for everyone else. So look on hackerpublicradio.org, try to figure out when the show starts, and either listen in or join the Mumble chat and join in. And it's a lot of fun. I've done the Hacker Public Radio New Year's shows for two or three past years that we've done it. It was a lot of fun. Previously, I've been on for like 12 hours and then 24 hours and then 24 hours again, or maybe just twice, I don't know. But this year, I don't think I'll probably be on it because, like I said, I'm moving to New Zealand. I'm kind of busy. But you should be there, so go. Go to hackerpublicradio.org, join in, listen in, whatever. And it's a lot of fun. Lots of just geeky chat while the New Year ripples through the world, and different people announce when, hey, it's New Year's now, and I'm in, I don't know, Abu Dhabi or wherever they are. So listen in and enjoy. Which actually also reminds me, and this is related to New Zealand, if you yourself are in New Zealand listening to this show, send me an email, let me know. Maybe we can meet up when I get there. I believe I've already discovered one hacker convention there. I think it's called KiwiCon or HackerCon Kiwi or something. And I think there's a local Linux user group there. So I'll be in Wellington area, so that's where I'll be. So let me know if you're in New Zealand. I'd love to chat. Okay, one thing before I get started on the programming stuff. 2600. 2600 is a Hacker Quarterly. You may or may not know the magazine. It's a good one. It comes out again quarterly I don't think it's the winter 2013 edition. It's not the one with the, like, I think it's an ATM with a bunch of icicles on it or something like that. It's kind of weird. That's not the one. It's the next issue, which I think has, it's not autumn 2013, it's whatever is next after autumn 2013. So when that comes out, there's going to be, from what I understand, an issue, or an article rather, on GPG encryption, obviously inspired by the recent NSA revelations that just seem to keep coming. You know, it's amazing. They keep popping up these revelations about the NSA, what they've bought themselves back doors on and all that other stuff. But there's an article on GPG in there by Klaatu, that would be me. So if you don't regularly buy the 2600 magazine, you might want to go check it out. And I believe that it should be out in January of 2014. I mean, again, it's a quarterly magazine, so I think that would be when it would be out. Maybe a little bit later, I don't know. But check that out if you're not a regular reader. You should look at the magazine. It's a lot of fun. It's a good little magazine. Lots of interesting articles, very rich culture and history behind it. So that's the 2600 magazine. And I've seen it at Barnes & Noble bookstores in real life. I've seen it at some, you know, alternative, air quotes around alternative, culture shops. So just kind of look around for it. But you can also buy it in multiple formats on 2600.net. Okay, time for a little bit of programming practice. This time we're going to be talking about Python. Oh wait, it's time for a coffee break already. What do you know? Okay, well, let's go get a cup of coffee, then we'll come back and we'll program. Coffee and programming, kind of, you know, classic combination anyway, so it worked out. Coffee and code. It's almost as good as pizza and code, or pizza and coffee. In fact, if you have pizza nearby, have coffee, pizza, and we'll do some coding, and you'll be in heaven. Okay, so Python, we all know Python. It's kind of the ubiquitous, all-purpose language that most people love. Some people love and also get annoyed by it, and there are arguments for all of these feelings. But Python's a really cool one. It's especially nice because it is just so easy to get started with, and it's just got such a rich set of supporting libraries that there's, you know, you start to realize there's just not a whole lot you cannot do with it, which is a really nice feeling in a programming language. And I wasn't really sure about Python for a while, and I got started, you know, mostly with Bash was the stuff that I started with. And Bash is one of those things that is just insanely useful for kind of a set of things, and obviously it becomes noticeably less useful once you start doing, well, I mean, object-oriented things, obviously, where you need, you know, different threads, and, well, you can do different, I guess, parallel stuff with Bash, but, you know, you need stuff, asynchronous things to be happening. Bash does that a lot less than something like, well, C++. But the problem with C++ is that it's kind of the opposite end of the spectrum. It's very complex. It's not so easy to get started with right out of the gate, especially when you're teaching yourself this stuff. So there's this kind of like middle ground Python where it really does seem to straddle a lot of different requirements for a lot of different people doing a lot of different things. So Python's a great thing to learn, I think, and it's a great thing to teach. And so far I've taught a Python and Pygame class and really, really enjoyed it, and I think the students really, really enjoyed the you know, learning Python as well, and the speed with which they could make at least, you know, semi-interesting things happen. It's not as if, though, it's an afternoon of lessons and suddenly you're just doing these incredible mock-ups of really complex programs. It doesn't happen like that. It does take a lot of time, a lot of practice, and probably most importantly, it takes a project. And I think that's one of the most important things to learn across the board in programming, at least for me. And actually, Ken Fallon had emailed me and kind of said that he sort of disagreed with this, but for me, I find that hitting yourself with a bunch of information and technicalities and sort of technical specs and the whole reference book of all these things that something can do, for me at least, that doesn't tend to be the best way to learn something, and that the best way to learn for me is project-based learning, whereby you have something that you want to achieve and you kind of hack your way through some language in this context in order to achieve that goal, to get that task completed. And so if you're sitting around saying, yeah, I really do need to learn like Bash or I really need to learn Python, then one of the things that you probably really need, unless, you know, if you're not going to go sit down and just read the Python in a nutshell complete reference, you know, this 500 page kind of technical manual, if you're not going to just sit down and read that and then go and start using it, which I can't again really imagine doing, but Ken Fallon says he does all the time, sort of. I'm misquoting him, but he understands. So, you know, if you're not going to do that, then what you probably really need is a project, and sometimes it's hard to find the right project. That's strangely the one of the more difficult things sometimes. One of the reasons is because there are so many applications out there that have already been written, and they do the thing that frequently you want to have done. I mean, heck, let's say you want to convert a folder of images from TIFFs to PNGs or to JPEGs, whatever. You know, you might think, well, that's a perfect project by which I can learn the for loop in Bash. Well, it's true, it is, but you could also just go to commandlinefoo.com or .org or whatever it is and look up how to do that, and you'll probably find three different line commands or maybe even a program or like a function of image magic or something where you can do that just like that. Or you might go to SourceForge and might find a GUI application or a plugin for Dolphin or Thunar that does that for you in a couple of clicks. So it's difficult sometimes to avoid the things that have already gotten done. But if you find a good project that can be solved by Bash, or in this case, Python, then that's a great way to learn. And it can be a little bit frustrating sometimes because then you're spending a lot of time learning how to solve your problem when technically speaking, the problem could be solved, you know, with someone else's solution. But if you do that, then you're not going to learn. So a little bit of discipline there. But that's how I learn. So if you can find a project, that's always good. Okay, so enough of that. So let's just talk about some of the basics of Python, because I feel like we talked about the basics of Bash, and I feel like you probably have sort of the feel for how things are done in Bash. You have, based on the DICE program that we wrote in the previous episode, you know about things like variables, for instance. So variables Well, so first I should say, okay, so Bash kind of inherently, it runs inside of a terminal emulator. Yes, you open up Xterm or URXVT or console or GNOME terminal, whatever. You open that up and you are in Bash. You are at a Bash prompt as long as you have Bash set as your default shell. Well, Python, as it turns out, also has a shell, and not all programming languages really have this, but Python does, and it makes it great for debugging and for learning and for trying things out before you commit them to a script and then run the script only to see it fail horribly. So the Python shell is called IDLE, I-D-L-E, and it runs potentially, like very frequently, the way that we are introduced to it is within a terminal emulator, but it's important to understand that that's not necessarily where IDLE, you know, is. It's, you don't mistake it for a, it is not Bash. If you type in Python at a Bash prompt, then you enter a subshell of Python. But it's important to understand that that's not, just because it's in the same black box as Bash doesn't mean that it's aware of where, you know, of anything. And that kind of confused me at first, because here I am in Python, but I mean, it's still the same terminal, so I should be able to access files on my computer, right? Well, no, you can't, because Python doesn't know about that stuff. It's its own little application. If it helps, you can run IDLE in some other program, and it isn't a bad idea to get started with integrated development environments, or IDEs, pretty early on anyway. And there's a really good IDE specifically designed for Python called ERIC. ERIC as opposed to IDLE. Remember our Monty Python references here. So ERIC is a, I think it's Qt-based, I'm pretty darn sure it's Qt-based, and it is an IDE, and it's pretty basic, I would say, but it's great because if you get started with ERIC, then suddenly the whole motif of, okay, this is an IDE, and this is kind of some of the things that IDEs do for me, and some of the things that they can take care of for me, some of the references that they have available to me. And then when you graduate onto something a little bit more complex, like Qt Creator, or Eclipse, or I guess NetBeans must still be out there, you know, you start looking at these, and suddenly the IDE, the concept of the IDE is not so foreign to you. So if your distribution has ERIC available, and Slackware does, if you go to the slackbuilds.org, you can find ERIC there. And I would imagine, I can't imagine a distribution not really having ERIC available. I mean, some I'm sure may, but you should be able to find it pretty easy. So ERIC, if you install that and launch it, then it will launch, its default configuration is kind of with a file system panel on the left, or a project panel. It could be a couple of different things. On the left, an editor on the top, which is kind of empty for now. And then at the bottom, you should see IDLE, which you may not recognize as IDLE, but it is, and you can kind of identify it, because there are, the default IDLE Python prompt are three greater than signs. And if you type in something, like, I don't know, print paren, quote, hello, space, world, close quote, close paren, and hit return, then it echoes, essentially, hello world back at you in the IDLE shell. And that's proof that you are in Python, because that was a Python command, or a Python line of code. So let's talk, whether you're using, you know, if you're not going to use ERIC, you don't have to, you can just open up an Xterm or whatever, a terminal, and type in the word Python, and it should deliver you again to the IDLE prompt, which is three greater than signs, and you should be able to do Pythonic things there. Okay, so one of the things that we can do is create variables. And variables, as I said in the Bash lesson, they're really the currency of programming languages. I mean, they absolutely do everything in programs. You're always assigning variables, especially, I guess, I mean, it really all the time, but I was going to say especially in object-oriented languages, because you've got all of these classes that you've got, these methods, and you're creating instances of them But in order for them to become real, you know, in order for them to sort of to manifest themselves in your program, you need to assign them to variables, which you can then throw around as if though they were, you know, those are the objects in the term object-oriented languages. So in order to create a variable in Bash, of course, you would have just simply, you can do something like, for instance, dessert equals cupcake, and then if you echo $dessert, of course, you'll see the string cupcake. And then you could even change it, dessert equals, I don't know, cake. And I guess cupcake and cake are very similar, but anyway, you could do that, and then you could echo $dessert, and it would just say cake. So that's throwing around variables in Bash. Well, in Python, you have to do it a little tiny bit differently, because Python has concepts of different types of data. There are strings, there are characters, there are integers, things like that, so we have to tell it to assign dessert equals quote cupcake close quote, and then you don't, of course, use the term echo in Python. That's a Bash command. In Python, you use print. So if you type in, if you've already typed in dessert equals quote cupcake close quote, now it is assigned the variable dessert to the string cupcake to the word dessert, the variable dessert. And now we can type in print parentheses dessert, and then close parentheses, and then you get the string cupcake back. Now, notice that we didn't say, for instance, print paren quote dessert, because if you do that, then you simply get the word dessert back, because you've now you're telling it to print the string dessert back out at you, and it does that. But if you just issue the variable itself without any quotes around it, then it knows that it's essentially, for instance, like saying $dessert in Bash. Technically speaking, you don't actually even, at least within idle, you don't actually have to use the print command in Python. You can simply type in dessert at the idle prompt, hit return, and it returns single quote cupcake close single quote. So it's telling you, hey, this is a string of characters that I have within this variable, and here you go, that's what it is. Now, if you, for instance, type in dessert equals 7, and that's the number 7, then it's seeing that variable the variable contents as an integer. And you could say, you could type in dessert on the idle prompt, and it returns the number 7 without any single quotes around it. So you can kind of see right there that it has a concept of different data types that you're feeding it. Bash rolls with it. You know, it doesn't care whether you're giving it letters or numbers until you start trying to do weird things with letters and numbers that cannot be done. But it's pretty adaptive. Python is a little bit more strict. Now, it's not nearly as strict as something like C++, where you have to actually specifically tell it what kind of variable it's going to receive at some point in the future. But it's stricter about whether you can just give it the word cupcake, or you can give it a number and then add a number, you know, add something to that number. So, for instance, if we say dessert equals 7 and then dessert plus 1, then it prints as the result the number 8 for us, and that's because we've given it the integer 7 in that variable, and so it knows it's an integer, and that's what it can use that integer for addition and subtraction, all kinds of mathematical functions, which would be important if you were doing something like a scoreboard or a health ranking or whatever. Now, if we go back, if you hit the up arrow a couple of times back to your command where you had called dessert equals quote cupcake close quote, now it's a string of characters, and if we try to do something wacky like dessert plus 1, it simply gives us an error. It says type error, you can't take a string and an integer and make them mix, because that doesn't make any sense. You're asking me to be both a calculator and a dictionary at the same time, and those aren't compatible. But that's assigning variables, and that's getting variables back out. And it's obviously very, very useful because variables are going to be everything from user input to computer output to different, you know, invoking different methods. All kinds of things are done with variables in programming, which I think you've already seen in the bash dice example, and we'll see it again as we continue. So those are very, very important. Get to know how they work. Get to know when you cannot mix types of variables and how to convert variables, and you'll do well. All right, so those are variables. The next thing about Python that I've always found kind of interesting are the different functions and modules that Python has to offer. So think about Bash again, since we started with Bash. Let's use that as our standard. So if we do something like echo $dessert pipe tr square bracket colon upper colon square bracket space square bracket colon lower colon square bracket, then we would have cupcake, which was the contents of the dessert variable, echoed back to us. But before it got back to our eyes, it would be passed through that pipe, right? And it would be handed over to the tr, the translator, transform, or whatever that stands for, command. And it will take any uppercase letters and transform them to lowercase letters, and then we will see the results of that command. That's how Bash processes data. It does that with pipes, data streams. Python does not do it like that, and in fact, I do not personally know of a programming language that really does it that way. That seems to be a little bit unique to Bash. Now, I could be wrong. Real programmers who have taken lots of classes and been around for a while could totally tell me that that's wrong. I'm just saying, more often than not, I think in most modern programming languages, you're not really going to see that occur. What's more common are functions that you can use within the programming language to modify existing containers of data. So for instance, if we have dessert equals cupcake, and then we say dessert equals str.upper paren dessert close paren, and then we print dessert, then we are left with the word cupcake all in capital letters. So it's very much like piping it through tr, for instance, in that case, but we don't use the pipe symbol. We use this convention of some function from some module dot some function and then paren and then whatever we want to affect. Now, the hard part about that, I guess, is knowing what's available to you. Sometimes it's kind of getting a feel for how to use it, but a lot of times it's simply kind of the way that you can even find out about these things. So Python delivers a lot of extra functionality in these things called modules. And so usually what happens is that it's the module dot and then some function and then followed by a variable or whatever. Very frequently it's a variable. So the module, if you know of a module, and you want to learn more about it, you can always do help paren str close paren, and str in this case would be the str module. Not necessarily, you know, I mean, that's not always what you're going to want help on, but that would be one thing that you could do. You could do help paren os close paren, and then you would get a help screen of all the things available in that. So some modules are built into Python, and when I say they're built in, you get them when you install them. It doesn't necessarily mean that idle has them loaded into sort of that session. So if I do something like, the string one is loaded and ready to go pretty much from the start. But if I do something like, I don't know, os.getcwd paren paren, then I get a traceback error in Python telling me that it has no idea what OS dot anything means because it's got no idea what OS is. It turns out that OS is a module that I happen to know about, and it's a pretty popular module, and I didn't install it separately. It came with Python when I got my computer, and it's got Slackware on it, and I installed 14.1. It's got the OS module along with all the other Python stuff. As always, these things aren't really a mystery. They're not a secret. You can actually see most of them for yourself, and you can do that by going to /usr/lib or lib64, whatever is appropriate for your system, /python2.7, for instance, or python asterisk if you're feeling brave, and then look in there, and you'll see all kinds of modules that have been installed for you by the Python distribution itself, or possibly by your distribution maintainer, or possibly by you yourself, whether you knew it or not. Sometimes you get those extra modules just because you installed, you know, some Python-based program, and that gave you some dependencies that you may not have realized you had. So that's one way of getting modules. And then additional modules can be found, of course, by simply installing the modules themselves. You know, you can go out onto the internet and find all kinds of different Python modules out there. And Pygame, for instance, is a whole library of essentially just modules for Python. So you can import Pygame and then do all kinds of fancy things that Python provides for you. Some you know, methods and things that Python has already, or that someone in Pygame has already figured out for you, so you don't have to write everything from scratch, and those are what modules are. So our first Python program will be very, very simple, but what we'll do with it is we'll re-implement in a very, very basic way the list command in a Unix shell, and I do mean a very basic way, but I think this will help you get the idea of how modules work and how Python works and just kind of the basics. So let's get going with that. Okay, so the module we're going to use in our list clone is the OS module. And the reason, again, that we need the OS module is because Python inherently does not have any awareness of the operating system that it is running upon. Again, you could probably argue with me on some level there, but for all practical purposes, it doesn't know anything about what it's running on. It knows that it's Python and that it can execute Python executable things, and that's about it. In order to bring it an awareness of its environment, you need to import this OS module, and the OS module, of course, will then be able to tap into your local file system and look at files and directories and all that other stuff. So that's important. So if we are in the Python, you know, in the idle shell, then we can do something, for instance, again, like os.getcwd --, and we get an error. But if we do something like import OS, then we've just imported the OS module. And again, don't think that that's magic. You can look for the OS module in your library in /lib64/python2.7, for instance. That's what I'm running right now. os.py, and yep, there it is. It's right there. You can even do a less on that and look exactly at what's going on. Like, you can see all this stuff. So it's not anything mysterious or, you know, obfuscated at all. It's right there for you to look at. Okay, so we've imported OS. Now if we type in os.getcwd --, suddenly it tells me exactly where I am. It says /home/cloud2 --. And that's how you can get your current working directory in Python. Now, why, and we're not done, that's not all. So why am I in /home/cloud2? Well, that's because when I typed in Python, that's where I happened to be. So if we were somewhere else, then you might see some other string there if you'd happened to been in your code directory or your documents directory or whatever. That's what you would see. So importing a module that way, like import OS, that imports everything from that module, and it does not change the namespace of your environment. So in order, for instance, so if you say git cwd paren paren, then you get an error. But if you do os.git cwd paren paren, then it works. If you want it to, you know, in some cases, that's a little bit bothersome, and you can do it a little bit differently. You can do Python, or rather, I'm re-entering my Python shell. So if you quit paren paren, then you'll get back out to bash, or if you're in idle, or rather, if you're in Eric, you pretty much have to quit Eric and restart it to be able to change your environment like that. At least that's how I know how to do it. I there may be another way, but I don't know how to. So if you're in Eric, close Eric and restart it. If you're just in idle, just type quit paren paren and you'll get out to bash again. Then type in Python again. Now, if of course we do the os.git cwd paren paren, it gives us an error because we haven't imported OS. So we could do import, rather, from OS import asterisk. Now that actually changes the namespace. And if you don't know what that means, try typing in git cwd paren paren. And it works. So before we had to preface git cwd paren paren with os dot, but now that we've done the import as from os import, you know, asterisk, so everything, now suddenly we are able to just refer to these things without the os dot prefix. I don't know that there's a preferred way of doing that. I mean, some people, I think, just get tired of typing all those prefixes all the time, and so they do it one way. Other people don't care, and so they don't do it the other way. So there's you know, always debate over the most, quote, Pythonic way of doing something, and both of these two things work and are acceptable. So that's that. One changes namespace, one does not. And namespace matters, I think, even more later on when you get into like C++ or Java, stuff like that. So it's not a horrible thing to be familiar with. And you can make up your own namespaces, to be honest. You can import OS as, you know, I don't know, something else. Like if you could rename it. And then you can type in, like for instance, import OS as Klaatu. And now if you type in klaatu.get cwd paren paren, it actually still works. Because again, you've changed the namespace. So that's just sort of an FYI. I wouldn't get too bogged down with that myself, but it is something to be aware of. Okay, so importing is important. You have to do it, and now we have done it. So let's talk about this re-implementing listing, re-implementing the list function in the Unix shell on a simple way. Well, one of the things I've just given you a hint on, and that is git current working directory. So that would be one thing that you would have to do, right? You would have to get your current working directory in order to be able to list your current working directory. So probably you're probably already thinking, oh, I probably need a variable. And you'd be right. You need a variable so that you can tell the computer, hey, send me your current working directory. Remember, that computer can't really talk to you unless it has a variable through which you both can communicate. So the OS, I mean the computer, rather, Python, needs a variable. It will go get the current working directory and put it into the variable. Then you can see the variable, and you can pass that variable onto something else and do some other thing. In this case, if you want, you know, if this were you, for instance, you might do help paren os, close paren, and then you would be able to see all the different functions within the OS module. And that could tell you something. And if you scroll down a lot and read probably more than you care to read, I mean, it's not necessarily the most user-friendly format by any means, but if you do look at it, you will eventually see something called listdir. So listdir is a function of OS, just like getcwd is, and its purpose, of course, is to, as the help file says, return a list containing the names of the entries in the directory. So it tells you how to use it. It says list dir paren path, close paren, and that results in a list of strings. And indeed, it says the path is the path of the directory to list. Okay, so in theory then, if we give a variable to get CWD and then give list dir that variable, we should get a list of all the files in that directory. And we can try this out. So let's say dessert equals os dot get CWD paren paren. And then we could, of course, just type in dessert, and it would tell us, yes, you're in /home/clat2. Okay, that worked. And then we could say, well, now we want to do an os.listdir paren dessert, close paren. And sure enough, that spits out a full listing of your directory, of your current working directory. It's not pretty. You could work at parsing that a little bit better and presenting it in a prettier fashion, but that does indeed work. And that's what we wanted. So if you can, if you could write that out in a file and execute this anytime you wanted, of course, that would be even better. So just do an Emacs on, I don't know, ls.py maybe. And so the first line, of course, would be from os import get CWD. And then from the next line could be from os import list dir, because those are really the only two functions from os we need, so we may as well just import them exclusively. And actually, I'm already misinforming you. The first line should be shebang, and you should know this. You should have predicted this anyway. Shebang /usr/ /env, that part you probably didn't know, actually. env space Python. Now, the env command is a little bit misused here from what I understand, but people use it a lot this way anyway. And what it does is it, rather than telling this little Python program specifically which Python to use, we're saying use whatever the user wants to use when we invoke Python. Why would we want to do that? Well, you might not, for yourself, you may not care. I don't really care. But, you know, if you're debugging Python or something, if you're a Python developer, and in your path, in your natural path of execution, the nightly build of Python appears first, and Python appears later in your path, then using this prefix, this /usr/bin/env space Python, will obey your path. Whereas if you, the programmer, specifically define /usr/bin/python, then that's going to run usr bin Python pretty much no matter what the user wants. So I feel like the env thing respects the user's wishes more so than, you know, defining what the programmer thinks should happen. And that's always a good thing, so I tend to favor usr bin env space Python. Okay, so that's the first line. Second and third line would be, well, second line for me is a blank line, but third line could be from os import get CWD, fourth would be from os import list dir, and then I'm going to do another blank line for readability, and then I'm going to say, for instance, locate, all capitals, just to sort of set it apart as a variable, get CWD paren paren. So that dumps the current working directory into the locate variable. Next line we'll say list, capital L, capital I, capital S, capital T, just again to set it apart. So list equals list dir paren locate close paren. So now we're just invoking the list dir function of the OS module upon the variable, the contents of the variable locate. And then in the final line, we'll type out print paren list close paren. And that, of course, prints for the user the contents of the variable list, which, of course, right now contains the entire contents of the current working directory. Not at all complex. In fact, it's very basic, and only a crazy person would use this instead of the Unix list function. But it does the same thing, and it introduces you to the concept of variables, of how to affect them with different functions, how to import new modules, and basically to make Python a lot more useful because a lot of Python beginning programming guides, you know, essentially teach you how to do basic math and how to capitalize or make lowercase different strings, and that's not very interesting. So this actually does something semi-useful, albeit in a very ugly kind of clunky way. But hopefully that gives you some idea of what Python is capable of. And in the next episode, we will talk about Python again, but this time we will go full object-oriented, and we will do a dice game in which you can let the user themselves decide just how many sides the dice that they're about to roll contains. But that is a different lesson for a different day. So practice Python in the meantime. I think you will enjoy it. It's a really cool little language. And again, if you want to follow along with all of this stuff, most of it's coming from straightedgelinux.com/blog/python. If you go to that general area, you will see the Python book, the programming book rather, and the first 8 or 9 chapters really, really goes over a lot of Bash. So if you don't feel like you've practiced Bash enough, work through the first 8 chapters of that before next time, and you'll be a lot more familiar with kind of the conventions of basic programming. Chapter 10 is basically what we did today. It ends with the list.py program. So that will give you a good little intro to Python, which you've just heard. And then next episode, we'll skip ahead a little bit to chapter 13 for the object-oriented dice game, and then we'll go back and probably do some Pygame stuff together later. But next time, we'll be doing the dice game. So that's some homework for you, some reference material for you. Hopefully you've enjoyed this as well as the previous episode. I got a lot of good feedback about the idea of doing this programming series, so I feel that we're onto something. So we'll just keep going with it. Just keep practicing in the meantime. So until next time, I will talk to you again. And not next episode, but the episode after, I'll probably be speaking to you from New Zealand. So if I sound any different, that would be why. Thanks for listening. That's it for this week's episode. Thank you very much for listening. My name is Klaatu. You can reach me via email at klaatu@member.fsf.org. You can find me online at gnuworldorder.info or slackermedia.info. You can contact me via Jabber at notklaatu@jabber.org. You can also usually catch me in IRC as notklaatu. I'm on the Freenode network in the channels Ogcast Planet, Dev Random, Slacker Media, Slackware, any of those will do. Thank you very much for listening, and I'll talk to you next time.
Just so many stages of crazy.